Real quick at the top of the episode here, my new book, How to Turn 39, which is a book about aging and how we might age better and things that we might be thinking about when it comes to growing older with intention at any age, wherever we might be in our lives. That is now available as an ebook, as a paperback, and as an audiobook. Wherever you get your books, you can find a list of links to different marketplaces other than the typical Amazons of the world at howtoturn39, that's the numbers 3and9.com. That said, let's get to episode 412 of Let's Know Things. In January of 2024, Chinese tech giant Huawei brought an end to its years-long U.S. lobbying effort meant to help mend fences with Western politicians. In mid-2019, then-U.S. President Trump had blacklisted the company, using an executive order that, in practice, prevented Chinese telecommunications companies from selling specialized equipment in the U.S. as part of a larger effort to clamp down on the sale of Chinese 5G and similar infrastructure throughout the U.S. Around the same time, a Huawei executive was jailed in Canada for allegedly violating sanctions on Iran, and several other Western nations were making noises about their own bans, worrying, as Trump's administration said they were worried, that Huawei and similar Chinese tech companies would sell their goods in foreign countries at a loss or at cost, significantly undercutting their foreign competitors' prices, and as a consequence would both lock down the burgeoning 5G market, including all the infrastructure that was in the process of being invested in and deployed, putting their competitors out of business with those pricing tactics, while also giving the Chinese government a tool that could allow them to tap all the communications running through this hardware, and potentially it would even allow them to shut it all down if they wanted at some point in the future. If China invaded Taiwan and wanted to keep the West from getting involved by shutting down the entirety of their telecommunications network, for instance. So while part of this ban on Huawei, for which the president made use of the International Emergency Economic Powers Act and declared a national emergency, was undoubtedly political and part of the trade war that Trump started as part of his China is the enemy platform that he was leveraging leading up to the 2020 election. While that was true, part of it was political, there were also real deal concerns about China insinuating itself into the world's infrastructure, beginning with the rollout of the next phase of communications technologies, disallowing foreign competition, and yes, possibly even creating a bunch of back doors they could use at some point in the future to tip the scales in their favor during a conflict, in theory at least. This ban also ensured that Huawei's then quite popular line of smartphones would not be available in the US or many other Western countries. The company sold off its Honor brand of phones in a scramble to try to protect that line of products from these new blocks on its offerings, which, among other things, disallowed them from accessing the chips necessary to make competitive smartphone products. But the legislation just kept coming after that initial salvo, the U.S. Federal Communications Commission banning the sale or import of anything made by Huawei in late 2022. And a bunch of fundamental U.S. allies, especially those with which the U.S. collaborates on military and intelligence matters, have likewise banned Huawei products on their shelves and in their communications networks. The idea being that even one Huawei transmitter, or modem, could tap into the whole of these networks if it was a part of it. Again, at least in theory, which is considered a big enough security concern to justify that blanket ban. Huawei has managed to survive, though it did not scale the way its owners seemed to think it would back before all these bans kicked off. Now it exists as a primarily regional outfit, still making billions in revenue each year, though down to about half the revenue it was earning before 2019. Another popular Chinese tech company, DJI, is now scrambling to deploy its lobbyists and circle the wagons, as there is word that it is on the short list of potential Chinese security threats. In this case, because the company makes very popular consumer and professional grade drones, which have successfully outcompeted many Western brands of the same, and which have thus started to dominate aspects of the drone market. These drones tend to be of the 6 or 8 mini propeller variety, the kind that people fly for fun or to shoot aerial photography. But the success of drones, even this kind of drone, in Ukraine, reworked to spy on enemy fortifications and to carry explosives, has had the US Defense Department thinking it might not be the best idea to allow a Chinese company to own a substantial chunk of the US and international drone market, for many of the same reasons that Huawei was considered to be a threat, because that would allow China to continue to take out international rivals, allegedly, by stealing their competitors' tech, but also by continuing to back their companies with government support and funding, which makes fair and level competition a bit of an impossibility. These companies are doing well for many reasons, then, and some of those reasons are not replicable outside the tight relationship the Chinese government has with its corporate entities. That, among other things, allows them to operate at a loss for a very substantial period of time. If DJI is ultimately targeted in this way, it would likely be via a similar mechanism as the ban that was slapped on Huawei. New drones made by DJI would be unable to use the US's communications infrastructure, which would make their continued functionality in the country all but impossible. This would not ban DJI drones that are already owned by folks in the US, and it's anyone's guess as to how likely this will be to pass, as a bill to this end is currently working its way through the House, but DJI is already lobbying heavily and is more common and popular in the US than Huawei was, and there's a chance that it simply won't be worth the potential political fallout for those who vote to ban it if the bill does work its way further through the process. What I'd like to talk about today is another potential ban of a popular Chinese product, TikTok, and how such a ban might play out. You're listening to Let's Know Things. I'm Colin Wright. Learn more about Let's Know Things, subscribe to receive free email updates, and or become a supporter to receive monthly bonus episodes at letsknowthings.com. Back in 2020, the Trump administration announced that it was looking into banning TikTok, a popular vertical video-focused social network that operates a bit like a cross between Instagram and YouTube, and which was becoming especially influential with young people, so-called Gen Zers. TikTok is owned by a Chinese company called ByteDance, and ByteDance has a version of the same app in other countries, including in China, where it is called Douyin. That same year, TikTok hit back against the Trump administration with a legal challenge that said, in essence, the president was just trying to score political points by passing protectionist laws in the lead-up to an election, and that this move might have also been an act of revenge because there were young people on TikTok posting videos about a prank that they instigated at a Trump rally, which seemed to irk the former president. Around this same time, TikTok higher-ups began working on what became known as Project Texas, which was meant to help address one of the government's concerns and complaints that data and media shared on TikTok was sent to Chinese servers, which suggested all that information could be more easily siphoned off and used by the Chinese government. This project resulted in a reworking of how data on the platform is handled, bringing in US tech company Oracle to keep tabs on everything, ensuring that this data is safely managed and not sent somewhere the Chinese government can easily get it. A former employee of TikTok alleged in early 2023 that this project did not do what it was supposed to do, and TikTok's leadership said that this employee left before it was fully implemented, so they wouldn't know. Other involved people have spoken about their own takes on the matter since then, some of them saying the company is locked down tight, tighter even than most Western versions of the same, like Meta and Twitter, because of all the oversight it's receiving, while others have said that it makes big security claims, but it is not locked down and secure the way it needs to be. This concern is the result of a law in China that says basically, if the government tells you to hand something over, you do, or you can be stripped of all your wealth, you can be put in prison, you can even be killed. So ByteDance's leadership's claims that they have not handed this sort of data from TikTok over to the Chinese government and would not do so if the Chinese government asked them to, cannot be trusted, according to arguments against their claims, because they would, of course, lie about this if they had handed it over, and may not even be legally allowed to admit to doing so. But they also wouldn't really have a choice if they were asked. They would legally, in China, have to hand that data over. That is the big argument and concern on the US security side of things. The Chinese government works differently than the system in many other countries, and because of how integrated and entwined their government is with their market, every single Chinese business, like ByteDance, like Huawei, like DJI, should be considered a wing of the Chinese military, because in practice, they kind of are. Thus, as soon as these concerns about TikTok started to hit the mainstream consciousness, we began to see those federal efforts to do something about it, most of which were initially unsuccessful, except for the Project Texas effort, about which no one seems to be able to say with any certainty whether it was successful or not. At the state level, we also saw a bunch of bans on having the TikTok app on corporate and government devices, and in some places like Florida, Montana, and Indiana, we've also seen bans on Chinese individuals and Chinese companies acquiring land, working on some types of research, setting up factories, and other such things, all in response to these same concerns. All of which sets the stage for a piece of legislation that was passed by the US Congress earlier this month, April 2024, and then signed by President Biden, saying that ByteDance needs to divest itself of TikTok and soon. Otherwise, TikTok will be banned in the United States. The specifics are important here. First is that this legislation was passed as part of a bundle with legislation that also provided funding for Ukraine, Israel and Palestinians, and Taiwan. So this is generally being seen as a sweetener to some further right Republicans who otherwise would have opposed those funding efforts, and it may not have been passed if it had not been thus bundled with those other more ostensibly important line items. Second is that this is not a TikTok ban in the sense that Biden signed it and now TikTok is banned in the US. Instead, it says basically, TikTok can keep operating in the United States, but it cannot be owned by a Chinese company. Which again, if the Chinese government asks them to do spy or military stuff on their behalf and to lie about doing so, they would legally have to do that. So the idea is that TikTok itself is not the problem. It's those ties to the Chinese government and intelligence and military apparatus. Third is that the company now has 9 months to figure out a deal to sell the whole or part of TikTok to some more acceptable, which in this case means non-Chinese government entangled, owner. And the president has the option of extending that to a full year if it looks like a deal is about to be done, but needs a little more time. That is up from a previously proposed 6 months and is considered to be more realistic given the scope and scale of the company in question. And that scope and scale is point number four. TikTok is huge. It's an absolutely behemoth company with about 170 million users in the US alone and about $16 billion in revenue each year. That is nowhere near Meta's $134.9 billion of annual revenue, but it is still a colossal company that's generally considered to be worth more than $100 billion. Again, for the US assets alone. Though if the company were to sell everything except the algorithm that it uses to decide what videos to show its users, it's thought that price could drop to closer to $20 billion, which is still substantial enough that there wouldn't be many people or entities capable of affording it, and some of the big, well-moneyed tech players in the US like Meta and Google would be unlikely to even try, as their offers would probably be permanently held up by antitrust concerns within the current, fairly hardcore regulatory environment. So ByteDance is being told to sell their US assets within a year, and they may have to find a buyer willing to spend tens of billions of dollars for it, and that buyer would have to be acceptable to the same US government that is telling the existing owner it has to sell or be banned in the country. Now, analysts are mixed on whether this is a bluff or not, but at the moment, ByteDance's leadership is saying, in essence, no, We are not going to play this game. We would rather shut down the US version of TikTok than sell those assets. Part of the rationale here might be that the Chinese government is telling ByteDance's owners that they are not allowed to sell these assets. It could be a requirement that they are dressing up as staunch resilience to save face. It could also be that they did the math and realized that their US offerings, despite being worth billions of dollars, are nowhere near their most profitable assets. Those are in China, and they would rather double down on that larger market and other friendlier foreign markets than sell off something valuable in the US, which could then be used to challenge them in some of those other remaining markets. It can also be that they are holding out for a good deal or delaying, hoping that denying even the possibility of a sale will help their case in court. And they do, by some estimations at least, have a pretty solid case to lean upon. Some legal experts are saying their First Amendment rights are being violated, and in a 1965 Supreme Court case, Lamont v. Postmaster General, the court ruled that foreign-produced propaganda, in that case, communist propaganda, could still be distributed through the Postal Service because Americans have a First Amendment right to receive it even if they did not specifically request it. This is considered to be relevant here because one of the arguments against TikTok by the US government is that the Chinese government could adjust what they show people, favoring content that supports positions and views of the world that they like, over time adjusting the opinions and facts or pseudo-facts or seeming facts young people in particular are working from, which then, over time, could influence what they believe, how they vote, and so on. There have already been claims that TikTok favors pro-Palestinian content over pro-Israeli content, for instance, and it has long suppressed work that talks about the Tiananmen Square massacre and other things the Chinese government doesn't like. It doesn't generally fully disappear this stuff from the platform, but the algorithms show that sort of content to few people, which has a similar effect to deleting it on an app where people primarily discover things based on what they are shown by that algorithm. Of course, Facebook and Twitter and other networks have been accused of the same. In Meta's case, downplaying news and political content, which is something they've admitted to now. And in Twitter's recently, post-transition to X, they've been accused of favoring more conservative posts over more liberal ones. Though in both cases, and in TikTok's too, it's difficult to prove this sort of thing, and the algorithms are often black boxes rather than open code we can look at to judge objectively. So some such claims may be based on anecdote and on the complainer's own bias. And it's worth mentioning here that although the Chinese government, TikTok's leadership, and a slew of free speech rights groups have come down on TikTok's side, citing the US's First Amendment and the support it would seemingly have for the popular app and those who want to use it to exercise their speech, and for the company to exercise its own as well, sharing stuff those people watch, it's worth mentioning that China has regularly banned US social networks from its highly controlled and censored portion of the internet, clamping down on those that survive so hard that they don't really have much control, their data highly secured and allegedly tapped within China. So China is saying the US is in the wrong for doing something similar to what it does back home, though on a much smaller scale and more focused scale than China does. And one of the counterarguments being made by some folks in the US, including some who are typically hardcore free speech advocates, is, well, this is just a minor bit of tit for tat. Countries that remain open for US social networks will have their networks welcomed in the US in the same way. But those who don't, their futures are less clear, because why should the US allow that kind of potential security and influence risk when the other side refuses to do the same? There's a question here, then, of what the modern splintered internet is and how it should be treated, perhaps especially in free speech favoring democratic societies, now that we've moved past the veneer of free and open online activity everywhere on the planet. That has never been the case in China, and in many other countries around the world too. So the idea that the US and Europe and similar nations need to behave as if it is equally open and free everywhere seems a little outmoded, and some such entities, like the EU, have been regulating based on that reality, while the US has been slow to do the same. this could mark a moment at which the U.S. starts thinking along those same terms, or it could be another instance of maintaining the previous paradigm, despite all the hubbub and politicking, because that tends to be easier, and because the relevant laws have not been updated yet, so it's unclear who would win this case in court anyway. There's also the question of how expansive this particular bill will end up being. Does it apply to ByteDance's other apps as well, including the popular CapCut video editing app and its existing Instagram dupe Lemonade and potential future Instagram clone TikTok Notes? Further, does it apply to other Chinese-owned apps and other apps owned by companies in, for instance, Russia and other current and future antagonistic states? Also, to what degree will the law allow friendly nation states like Japan and European nations to scoop up these sorts of assets and operate them in the US in a way China would no longer be allowed to do, when there's a chance that some of them, Hungary, for instance, which is a European nation, but which has tended to favor Russia when it comes to politics, when there's a chance that some of them, like Hungary, might not always be so friendly. How does the friendly or unfriendly judgment get made, and what sort of process is involved in changing a nation's label from one to the other when the facts on the ground change? Right now, the framing of all of this is mostly whether we prioritize free speech or national security, and it is arguably the government's responsibility to make that argument or face the electoral consequences of seemingly behaving in anti-speech ways without any real purpose, beyond potentially empowering US-based social platforms like Meta over foreign versions of the same. And lacking a stronger argument and more public evidence, there is a decent chance a lot of people, especially young people, will be irked at a TikTok ban, or even the possibility of one, despite the supposed security threat it poses. All of which suggests this will be an interesting year, as the clock ticks downward on those 9 months, plus another 3 possibly, that ByteDance has to sell its US assets, during which several companies will probably arise, stating their case for scooping up the most popular social platform with young people in the country, and during which ByteDance's lawyers will be filing cases on their employers' behalf. And this will all go down as the country winds its way toward the November election, which features 2 presidents that have spoken out against the app in different ways and at different times, while also having used it for their own political gains, to try to reach the youths of the country, who will play a major role in this upcoming election, but also a whole lot of elections after that, well into the future. As I mentioned at the beginning of this episode, I've got a new book that just came out today. It's called How to Turn 39. It is about aging. It's for people of all ages to be thinking about the people that we grow into and what happens next in our lives, the things that we have control over, the things that we don't have control over. And if that sounds interesting to you, if you found value in my work in the past, consider picking up a copy wherever you get your books, and you can find a list of marketplaces where it's available at howtoturn39.com. That said, the book I'd like to recommend today is called The Spare Man by Mary Robinette Koval. This is a near future science fiction whodunit sort of story. And rather than trying to explain what it's about and not give away too much, I'm going to read you the publisher's provided copy about the book. And that goes like this. Tesla Crane, a brilliant inventor and an heiress, is on her honeymoon on an interplanetary space liner, cruising between the moon and Mars. She's traveling incognito and is reveling in her anonymity. Then someone is murdered, and the festering chowderheads who run security have the audacity to arrest her spouse. Armed with banter, martinis, and her small service dog, Tesla is determined to solve the crime so that the newlyweds can get back to canoodling and keep the real killer from striking again. This book is a lot of fun. The author's other work is also excellent. And if any of that sounds interesting to you, consider picking up a copy of The Spare Man by Mary Robinette Koval. You can subscribe to receive email updates, find show notes, and other such content, and support this show financially, receiving additional bonus episodes as a thank you at letsknowthings.com. Learn more about me and my work at colin.io. Subscribe to my other news-focused podcast, One Sentence News, wherever you get your pods, or at onesentencenews.com. and say howdy on social media. I'm at Colin is my name on Instagram and Twitter, and Colin Wright on Facebook and YouTube. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Colin Wright, and I'll talk to you again next week.